It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. February 12th was the 208th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution. Over the last couple of decades, there's been a movement afoot to establish an International Darwin Day that would be celebrated around the world. And the movement is growing. There are groups all over the world who've been organizing annual Darwin Day celebrations, and one of those groups is in Iowa City, where Darwin Day will be celebrated this weekend, March 3rd and 4th. Iowa City Darwin Day is bringing scientists from near and far to share some of their knowledge. And this hour, I'll talk with four well-known evolutionary scientists about some of their most interesting findings. And we're going to start with Rosemary Grant. She is Senior Scholar of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University, along with her husband, Peter Grant. She's spent the last four decades studying the famous finches in the Galapagos Islands, the finches that helped Charles Darwin formulate his theory. The Grants will be giving two talks at Darwin Day. One is called In Search of the Causes of Evolution, and the other, 40 Years of Evolution, a long-term study of Darwin's finches in the Galapagos. And Rosemary is here with me now. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today.
Not at all. Very nice to be with you.
And I know that you and your husband spent 40 years studying the finches in the Galapagos. For people who aren't familiar with these finches, they played an incredibly important role in the development of evolution or the evolutionary theory. Tell me a little bit about these finches for people who aren't already familiar.
They're a group of birds that live on the Galapagos. They live nowhere else but the Galapagos, and they're are a group of 13 species that have radiated, we now know from genetic work, in the last 2 million years, 1 to 2 million years.
And Darwin figured out or started to really bring this evolutionary theory into focus because of the differences he observed among these different finches that were found on different islands. And you mentioned over 2 million years, and 40 years is a long time for humans to be studying an animal. What can you observe? What did you observe in 40 years of observing these species?
Yes, I should say that we don't live for 40 years on the islands. We go down there for about, on average, 4 months each year. And then we have students also who have been at other times of the year. But in those 40 years, the Galapagos is an unusual place in that it lies astride the equator and it's subject to the southern oscillation phenomenon. So you get years when there's a lot of rainfall, and then you can also get years of complete drought. In fact, our longest drought has been 2.5 years. And so what we have observed is that during these droughts, birds die. And the ones that are actually survive, I should say up to about 80 to 90% of the birds can die in a very severe drought. And the ones that survive are dependent upon the food that is available. So, for example, if there are just large, hard seeds available, it's only the very largest members of the population that can survive. And because the beaks are highly heritable, in the next generation, the offspring also have large beaks. So this is a natural selection event. And because the characteristic large beaks is heritable, it is also an evolutionary event. A small one, but it is a small shift in the average population size.
So even in a period of 40 years, you and your husband were able to see evolution in action.
We were able to see this oscillation going backwards and forwards. We were able to measure it, and we knew in each case why the causes of that change.
These finches are unique in showing us their, their genetic changes in such a very visible way with these beaks. But what else makes the Galapagos such a good place to study evolution still?
Okay. Well, the reason that we went down, well, I can list the reasons which are good for not just the finches, but also other organisms that is good to study. There's a small set of islands, an archipelago that sits astride the equator. many of them are uninhabited by humans, and so any changes that you see are likely to be purely natural and not because of the presence of humans. They also, as I mentioned before, have this oscillation in climate because of the El Nino Southern Oscillation phenomenon, where you can get years of intensive rain interspersed with drought years. And this sets up the situation where you're likely to see changes in populations, not just in the birds, but also in other organisms as well.
When Darwin observed these birds, he came to the island and to these observations with far less knowledge than you and your husband did. Having an understanding of genetics, I mean, that gave you a whole new window into looking at these birds, right?
Exactly. And this has been very exciting because the genetic, the techniques for looking at the genetics is almost improving as I speak. And we went down, we collected a lot of measurements from the birds, but whenever we were measuring them, we took a tiny little drop of blood, just a little drop of blood, which we preserved on filter paper with a chemical. And we have this blood stored away, and we're able to look at the DNA. So now that the techniques have improved so much, we can even still go down back into our minus 80 freezer, get a tiny bit of this blood, and send it over to our collaborators who are geneticists in Sweden, and they can actually sequence the whole genome from these tiny little bits of blood. So we've been able to go back and say what was actually happening genetically at all these events that we were able to see in the past. And we have done that with some remarkable success.
That's extraordinary. The technology advanced so much during the period of time that you were studying these birds.
Exactly. I mean, when we first started in 1973, those techniques weren't at all available, and then they gradually became available in the 1980s. And now we have whole sequences of DNA from individual birds. So it's just absolutely incredible.
Are people continuing your study still?
We are continuing our collaboration with geneticists very actively at the moment. There's actually nobody on the islands at the moment. There may be later, but there are other groups of people doing work. Some of it is similar work to ours, and there's about five groups of people studying the finches and other organisms on the Galapagos, and we interact with those people a lot. So it's going on. The actual work on Daphne, the genetics is going on, but there's nobody there at the moment.
I'm sure scientists, biologists hang on your every word and want to know so much about what you researched. For lay people, what do you think the most important thing that we can take away from your study is?
Well, one of the things I think is that it's possible to see natural selection happening in real time, in our time, and with an evolutionary response. And, of course, we see this in antibiotic resistance and resistance to chemicals on fields, that sort of thing. But we've been able to show it in larger organisms, birds. The other thing that we have found is that there, occasionally, and for the reasons that we know, there is a hybridization between two species, a very, very small amount, about 1%, but genes are put in, and this augments the genetic variation, which selection can act on. But you can also get genes from one organism being put into another organism, which has an effect on their survival. We found one gene, or at least I should say that our collaborators in Sweden found one gene that was affected or contributed to affecting beak length. And when there was a change into small soft seeds, a pointed beak is much more efficient. So that was one of the genes that went in that contributed to that change in beak shape. Interestingly, this gene is the same that we see in humans. It causes cranial facial, part of the normal cranial facial development of humans, and the mutation in that gene in humans is responsible for cleft palate. So you get this, you know, very conserved genes, which you see both in birds and in humans as well.
I mentioned earlier that when you approached your research on these birds, you had so much more information at your disposal than Charles Darwin did when he first made his observations. What do you think he would be most excited about in looking at your research?
I think he'd be very excited about two things. First of all, that we've been able to show that his ideas of natural selection actually apply to the birds on the Galapagos, and I think he would be absolutely fascinated to know the genetic extension of this work, and to see that we can actually follow this from the underlying genetics, and that would surely thrill him, I think.
Rosemary Grant, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Rosemary Grant is Senior Scholar of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University. Along with her husband, Peter Grant, she spent 40 years studying the famous finches in the Galapagos Islands. And the Grants will be giving two talks at Darwin Day in Iowa City on Friday and Saturday. One of their talks is called In Search of the Causes of Evolution, and the other, 40 Years of Evolution, a Long-Term Study of Darwin's Finches in the Galapagos. And through the rest of the hour, I'll be talking with other scientists who will be presenting their work at Darwin Day. Coming up in just a moment, Anne Fausto-Sterling. She is Professor Emerita of Biology and Gender Studies at Brown University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration is coming up this weekend, March 3rd and 4th, bringing scientists together to share their knowledge and research in the field of evolutionary science. And Anne Fausto-Sterling is Professor Emerita of Biology and Gender Studies at Brown University. She studies gender and early childhood development, and she'll be giving talks on evolution and gender in the 21st century and also acquiring gender, from baby in a yellow hat to gender identity and expression. Anne, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Now, for most of us, it's pretty clear that we're born with a gender, and males and females of our species both serve an important biological function in perpetuating the species and passing those genes along. But obviously, your work goes well beyond that. What kinds of questions are you asking?
Okay, well, first, it's not so clear that we're born with a gender. We're born with a sex, that is, we have various body parts and chromosomes that are normally belong to one sex or another, but gender is a much more complicated construct that includes our sense of self. It includes how we present in the world, and it includes how the world perceives us and how the world, what kinds of expectations the world has of us.
And, you know, a lot of people have had the argument over the years about nature versus nurture. You think that that's kind of a flawed construct. So how do we start this conversation?
It is a flawed construct, in my point of view, because nature doesn't act independently of nurture and vice versa. So you always have to look at them together. They interact dynamically, and they have a history, so that what happens to your body at one point then conditions it so that it will respond a particular way at the next point. You often may think of something like the mother's touch as nurture, because the touch is nurturing. But the touch, a mother's touch, a caregiver's touch, affects neural development. It affects how the brain grows. It affects what kinds of nervous connections are made. So that's that's biology. That's nature. So you have nurture creating nature, and you also have nature providing a platform on which nurture acts. So you can never separate them. They are a what I call a dynamic system.
You have studied very closely, speaking of a mother's touch, you've studied how mothers interact with their infants and the differences between how mothers interact with infant girls versus infant boys. What kinds of differences do you observe?
Well, in the studies I've been doing, I have access to videotapes of mothers interacting with their children, with their infants at, from age 3 months to 12 months. And I've did a long, or I had students do with me, a long analysis in which we looked second by second at what kinds of interactions were going on. And we looked at how mothers touched infants. We looked at how much they spoke to them. We looked at whether they moved them around a lot. And what we found was, for example, mothers talk to their girl infants more than they do to their boy infants, even though the girl and boy infants are vocalizing at the same rate. On the other hand, mothers move their male infants around a lot more, and they support them a lot more in movement, in the especially in the early months, at say 3 months. It's more likely that we'd see a mother putting an infant girl alone in some kind of jumper seat. So the girl was supported and getting motor activity, but not with the mother's help. Whereas the mother would hold the boy up and suspend him by his arms and jounce him up and down on his legs to help him learn to stand. Mothers move boys around a lot more. And when they're moving boys around a lot more, they talk to them more, although overall they talk to them less. In that particular instance of engaging in motor activity, they chat away at them.
And when you're making these observations, do you have an opportunity to, for example, study the same mother with infants of different genders, or is it...
No, the way the study was designed, unfortunately, in a way, I mean, I think you raise an important question, which is to look at complicated families, but this study was designed with first-time mothers. So they either had a boy or they had a girl. So we had a sample of 15 dyads of girl mother dyads and 15 boy mother dyads that we could compare.
And seeing those differences, what questions, I realize that that doesn't necessarily allow you to draw conclusions, but what questions does that create for you?
Well, for me, it creates a whole series of questions about later motor activity, the rapidity of motor development, the kinds of motor interests, and then also that might differentiate boys and girls, say, by the time they get to be 2.5 or 3 years of age. And also it raises questions about language and vocabulary and about how those interact, because often psychologists study either language acquisition or motor acquisition, but they don't look at the interaction between the two. Whereas what I'm finding is that there's a lot of different components that go into a mother's behavior. That's not very surprising. Mother is talking while they're moving, while they're feeding. So it would be wonderful to do a study like this, focus in on some of the places where I think there might be differences, start at birth, take the children through until 2 or 3 years of age. And also it would be wonderful to do it with a more diverse sample with different family structures. There's a lifetime of work for somebody out there to take these preliminary findings of mine and develop them into a much more complex, thorough study.
But it certainly raises some very interesting questions, because we have this sort of common wisdom about differences between boys and girls, and boys tend to advance physically faster. Their motor skills tend to be stronger earlier. Girls tend to be more advanced in language and social skills. So from
those are the ideas. Actually, when you look at the literature, those ideas are not themselves so incredibly supported. They're slightly supported in the literature, but my observation suggests that in order to, that again, it's not so useful to, and this is the thing about dynamic systems also, is you need to look longitudinally. It's not so useful to take a cross-section, say at age three, and say, oh, the boys are running around and the girls are sitting and playing with coffee cups. Because what if you even if there is a difference that you observe at, say, age three, what's really interesting is to understand where behaviors come from and how they develop and emerge. And for that, you have to do the kind of study I've done, which is longitudinal. You have to study the same kids over time and see what different kinds of behaviors emerge and what are the different components that lead to their emergence.
There's so much more we could talk about here, but I want to touch on the other talk that you're giving, and I realize there will be a lot of overlap, but tell me about what you're trying to tackle with the questions that you're asking and looking at this moment in time.
Well, there's a long sort of fraught history of ideas within coming from the field of evolution about women and gender that, you know, Darwin was not exactly a feminist, and neither were a lot of evolutionary biologists who came after him. So I think I was asked, because I'm someone who's spoken out against sort of anti-female myths that permeate certain kinds of evolutionary theory. And I think that's what they wanted me to talk about. But then in conversation, we realized that we're in this moment in the 21st century where evolution itself is being questioned from the outside. And so the talk I'm giving really is about, it's using evolution as an example, but it's really about how do we talk intelligently about science in this cultural moment when there's so much anti-science out in the world. And I take some examples from studies on the evolution of gender to talk about this, but I really ended up creating a talk that's much more about what is science and is it threatened from within, is it threatened from without, and what's happening that's new in the field of evolution that is changing it from within, even at the same time that it's trying to defend itself from attacks from without.
Anne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome.
Anne Fausto-Sterling is Professor Emerita of Biology and Gender Studies at Brown University. She'll be speaking at Iowa City Darwin Day coming up on Friday and Saturday. And so will my next guest, Mary Kozlowski. She is a lecturer for the University of Iowa Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Her talk is entitled Crushing Crabs and Sinistral Snails, How a Super Predator Changed Snail Shape. Hello, Mary.
Hi. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And all right, first of all, let's kind of dive into your research. And the fact that you're sharing this is you're focusing on how a predator and the pressure from a predator can sort of trigger evolutionary changes.
Yes. So my research overall, I'm very interested in studying marine snails for a number of reasons. There's a lot of them, and they do interesting things. Something that people don't appreciate a lot of the time is that snails grow their own shells. So they have a tremendous capacity to respond over evolutionary timescales to different pressures in their environment, whether those are temperature or predators, different conditions that vary, that impose selective pressures on these populations.
And are they fairly short-lived creatures? Is this something that makes them a little easier to study and look for evolutionary changes?
That really depends on the snail. So the snails that I work with primarily, knobbed whelks, people frequently call them conchs, can live to be at least several decades old. So
no.
Yeah, depends on the snail. Some snails have much shorter lifespans. These ones tend to live for a while.
All right. Well, tell us about the crabs and the snails in this scenario, the crabs that are these very effective predators.
Okay, so in this project is a little project that I've been working on with a colleague at Cornell University, Warren Allman. And we've been looking at this for a number of years with a few other people as well. And what we were curious about is if you look at the fossil record in Florida, about 3.5 to 4 million years ago, all of a sudden you have two left-handed snails show up pretty much simultaneously. And I should probably explain what a left-handed snail is right now, because I think...
Yes.
People probably did not know that snails could be left-handed. But if you take a snail and you hold it so that the pointy part is up, it's going to open on either the right side or the left side. And almost all snails open on the right side. So over the last, well, I think I mentioned earlier, there are 200,000 living species of snails right now at this moment. Over the last 65 million years, left-handed snails have only evolved 19 times. So having two of them show up at one place pretty much simultaneously was something that made us really curious. And we wanted to know why that was happening and what might be driving these snails to show up and all of a sudden become left-handed. So in a question—
And there are some things that give a left-handed snail, in some ways at least, evolutionary disadvantages. Right. There are reasons that we don't see more left-handed snails.
Yes. And we think that primarily has to do with the difficulty of finding a mate. So becoming a left-handed snail is neat. It's an instance of single gene speciation in the cases where people have been able to tease it out. So you have this single gene genetic switch and in a mother, and then all of their offspring will be left-handed. So the issue with this is, while we don't think that being left-handed is necessarily a disadvantage, it's not going to really hurt the snail in many ways. They're really just mirror images of right-handed snails. They can't find mates.
Okay, so they can live a healthy life, but they mm-hmm. can't procreate.
Yep, they cannot mate with right-handed snails. It just does not work mechanically. So it's very difficult for them, even if they show up, to establish a population.
All right, so what might be the evolutionary advantage then for the snails you've been studying, since you're seeing more and more left-handed snails?
So, and the interesting thing we see in the fossil record showing up at about the same time as these snails is a very powerful crab predator, the stone crab. And this crab, to give you some context of how strong it is, I've done a lot of work with it in aquaria, and they are incredibly aggressive, and they can produce crushing pressures that are, to give you some context, they can produce about 19,000 pounds per square inch crushing pressure. Strongest human punch measured is only 3,000 pounds per square inch. So imagine a crab being able to crush something with more than six times the strength of the strongest
Wow.
human puncher. They're incredibly strong. And they show up at this time. And an interesting thing to know about these crabs is that these crabs are all born right-handed. So they show up. They're incredibly, incredibly strong. And they're all right-handed. And where it starts to get interesting and where we think this might matter for the snails is it turns out a right-handed crab is very bad at dealing with a left-handed snail. And one of my colleagues, Greg Deedle, has done a lot of work on this in John Hendricks, where they took a bunch of different snails and put them in, left and right-handed snails, and put them in with a different kind of right-handed crab. And it's very much like I'm left-handed myself. So it's very much being left-handed and trying to use right-handed scissors. A right-handed crab just does not know how to orient a left-handed snail.
Interesting. So the left-handed snails are not getting eaten. They're passing along their genes. They're having an easier time finding other left-handed snails to mate with.
Yeah, it looks like there's a tremendous advantage. And this is backed up also by additional fossil evidence that Greg Deedle and John Hendricks looked at, where another thing that people don't know about snails is that they can get scars. So you know how if you get a cut and it heals, you'll get a scar. Snails will do the same thing. If somebody attacks them, if a crab attacks them and they survive the attack, there's a record of that event that they will preserve in their shell. So what Greg and John did was they looked at a bunch of left and right-handed snails that were living at the exact same time, 3.5 to 4 million years ago in the same place. And they said, okay, well, do we see more of these repairs on left or right-handed snails? And the reason this is important and interesting is if you're seeing a lot of repairs on these snails, it means that they're experiencing a lot of attacks, meaningful attacks where they're getting injured. And they found that in almost all cases, the left-handed snails had a huge advantage, it looked like, where they just weren't getting attacked as much.
That's fascinating. So it's a fascinating story in a sort of a small picture way. Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left. What's kind of a big picture takeaway? Why, if you don't care about snails, why should you care?
So one of the kind of interesting things about this is if you look at what's going on right now with modern fisheries, the fisheries for these crabs, we only take the claws and we only take them above a certain size. So right now, these crabs are switching in a big way to become left-handed as a result of fisheries pressure. So we're not sure what this might mean for the future of left-handed snails. It's certainly going to take their advantage away, potentially. And I'd say the big takeaway is that humans modify systems pretty profoundly in a lot of different ways. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future with these changes.
And there are a lot of changes taking place, clearly, that we just can't see or haven't seen yet.
Yes.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely.
Mary Kozlowski, she is a lecturer for the University of Iowa Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Her talk is entitled Crushing Crabs and Sinistral Snails, How a Super Predator Changed Snail Shape. You can find out more about Darwin Day at iowacitydarwinday.org. And we will continue our conversations about environmental science, evolutionary science, in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration is coming up this weekend, March 3rd and 4th, bringing scientists together to share their knowledge and research in the field of evolutionary science. It also includes a workshop for science teachers. And my next guest will be giving two different presentations at Darwin Day, one on self-domestication in bonobos and humans, and another on how cooking made us human. Richard Wrangham is a biological anthropologist and primatologist, a professor at Harvard University, and founder of the Kibale Chimpanzee Project. Richard Wrangham, thank you so much for being here.
It's such a pleasure to join you.
And there's so much we could talk about today, but let's stick to the subjects that you've chosen for your presentations. And when we think about domestic animals, I think most of us think about dogs and cows and pigs, animals that humans have bred for various uses. What does self-domestication mean?
Well, self-domestication refers to the same kind of process going on in a species as happens when humans deliberately domesticate something. And actually, people even think that it might have happened with dogs, that they might have self-domesticated themselves. So the basic idea is that when you have domestication, an absolutely central feature of it is that there is a reduced tendency to show aggression. That's critical. You know, we can't stand animals living around us if they're going to be biting us all the time. So a key focus of domestication process is reduction of aggression. And in all of the domesticated species, we see certain things that happen in parallel. One of the remarkable ones is floppy ears. You know, domesticated species, they all tend to have floppy ears, some individuals at least, or others have white patches on their skin. All these things that happen as a consequence, an incidental consequence of selecting against aggression. And then the question that some of us have been asking for a year or two is, are there other species that are wild where selection has acted against aggression to reduce the amount of aggression that the species shows, and do they show some of the similar kinds of incidental consequences as we find in domesticated animals? And increasingly, there's evidence that that happens.
So one of the species that you believe that there's evidence of that happening is with bonobos. So tell me what you see when it comes to bonobos that make you feel like self-domestication has taken place.
Well, first of all, bonobos, which are the species of chimpanzee that are equally closely related to us as chimpanzees, but are very different from chimpanzees, the first difference about them is that they're much less aggressive. So that gets us thinking, well, you know, how did they get to be like that? Is it a consequence of selection against aggression from a chimpanzee-like ancestor? And then you say, okay, well, let's line up some of the similarities to domesticated animals. And there are two big ones. One is in the nature of the skull. So the skull of bonobos has features that you find often in domesticated animals, a short face and small teeth, and a small brain compared to chimpanzees. And then in addition, the differences between the sexes are greatly reduced compared to those that you find in chimpanzees. And the reduction in sex differences is because the males are looking more like females rather than the other way around. So that's one set of differences between bonobos and chimps. And then the other is to do with juvenile-like features occurring retained into adulthood. So bonobos are much more playful than chimpanzees as adults, and their behavior in a number of ways shows a delay in development. They stay close to their mothers for a longer period as they grow older. a number of domesticated animals show a similar sort of thing, with dogs showing juvenile-like behavior as adults, for instance, rather like bonobos. They play more than adult wolves do.
Well, one of the big benefits, I guess, if you'd call it that, to domestication when you look at dogs is that they benefit from their relationship with humans. We give them food. We give them shelter. We care for them. We protect them. With bonobos and this self-domestication, does it put them in greater danger in the wild? They don't have another species looking out for them.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah. No, I mean, what we think is going on is just that it so happens that sometimes evolution works in a way that increases the propensity for aggression, and sometimes it works to reduce it. And there's no goal in mind, as it were. It's just that sometimes natural selection works that way. And in the case of bonobos, it seems to have worked to favor a reduced aggressiveness, but it doesn't mean they're any more helpless. It just means that they happen to be a species in which aggressiveness does not pay so much, particularly for the males. And the consequence is actually rather beneficial for the bonobos, because it means that if you are a bonobo, life is a lot nicer than if you're a chimpanzee. There's much less likelihood that anybody is going to be beaten up on any particular day, or have their babies killed, or spend lots of time displaying and showing off. It's a calmer, gentler existence, but they're just as capable of finding their food in the forest and eating it and living a long and happy life.
Now, some of the things that you said about bonobos, I can see in humans the reduced differences between the sexes, juvenile-like features lasting later into life. We love to play, even though we're adults. But let's talk about our brains, because with domesticated animals, you usually see a smaller brain. But isn't it our brain that sets us apart from other species?
Well, that is a great point, and you're so right that in domesticated animals, it is essentially 100% of domesticated animals, they have a smaller brain, sometimes a lot smaller and sometimes a little bit smaller than their wild ancestors. Well, okay, you're right, of course, that in general what's happened with humans is that the brain size has increased over the last, say, 2 million years since we left our ape ancestors behind. But in the last 30,000 years, people have documented that the brain size has actually got reduced in African and European samples. And although we don't have a really confident explanation of this, one possibility is that we're seeing the same process as we've seen in domesticated animals. That the reason that we've seen a reduction in brain size is that, as in domesticated animals, there is selection in favor of a more juvenile, less aggressive type, and juveniles have smaller brains than adults.
What would have been the benefits for humans to follow this path of self-domestication?
Well, the benefits are incidental. You know, they're not planned, as it were. And just like bonobos or dogs, life is nicer in the sense that there's less aggression. The real question you have to ask yourself is, why did the process get going at all? And there, I think, an extraordinary answer has been emerging over the last few years, and that is that ultimately it traces to the development of language, and the significance of language is that, hold your horses here, it gives rise to the capacity for capital punishment. Because in a small social group, when you have somebody who is throwing their weight around in a really unpleasant way, even to the point maybe where they're committing a murder to get their own selfish desires fulfilled, then once you have language, the other people in the group can get together and say, you know, it's time to send that guy off to the heavens. And you find this in all continents, small-scale groups of people, they use capital punishment as the ultimate way to stop people behaving in ways that are truly antisocial. Well, it turns out, if you look at contemporary peoples and all the records of small-scale societies, that the people who get killed by capital punishment are very often the aggressors. And so the idea is that this led to a reduction in the frequency of those genes. In other words, by having an effective form of social control, an unanticipated long-term consequence was we bred a kinder kind of human being.
That's fascinating. So it was the ability of humans to work together, too, to plan, that allowed us to thrive, the individuals who were less aggressive to thrive.
You put your finger on it. Exactly. That shared ability to design an intentional plan, which, of course, is very critically dependent on language, because now we can gossip together and say, you know, I've got an idea. What do you think? And yes, I agree with you. And well, let's plan it. And when should we do it? And, you know, you wait for the good opportunity. One of the curious things about this whole system, of course, is that you're using aggression to control aggression, because, you know, what could be more aggressive than capital punishment? But it's critical to recognize that part of the aggression that is leading to the capital punishment is planned and cold and unaroused. It's a very different kind of aggression from the reactive aggression that you're controlling in the form of your social criminals, you know, people who lose their temper too easily and just grab for what they want.
Which, of course, brings us back to our brains. And the other presentation that you'll be giving at Darwin Day in Iowa City also relates to our brains and our brain development. It's about how cooking made us human. And was the ability to cook part of this self-domestication process?
Well, I don't think of it as being part of it, but I think it does, in a sense, pave the way for it, because the great problem that we have to solve for thinking about human evolution is how it is that humans were able to get enough food to fuel both a big brain and a relatively big body compared to the other primates. And the insight that a focus on cooking gives you is that cooking gives you a tremendous increase in the amount of energy that you can get out of your food. If you look back across the last 2 million years, then you see a steady increase in the brain size, and even an accelerating increase in brain size until very recently. And the thought now is that this was only possible as a result of eating a very high-quality diet from the point of view of providing energy. And nobody has yet really come up with any strong alternative, in my view, to cooked food as the source of that diet. Cooked food gave us big brains.
So 2 million years ago, that's earlier than previously thought, right, for actually cooking food?
It certainly is. So the standard wisdom about when fire was first controlled and therefore when cooking was possible looks at the archaeological evidence, very reasonably, of course. And the archaeological evidence is that back to about 400,000 years ago, then there's pretty consistent evidence about people using fire. But before then, you see it rather rapidly dying out. You see occasional sites. There's one in South Africa called Vandenberg at 1 million years, and there are others in Europe and Israel between those periods where people are very satisfied that there was control of fire, but nevertheless, nothing totally convincing. So most people, thinking about the archaeological evidence, tend to focus on that period sort of around 500,000 years ago as when humans controlled fire. But here's the problem. If you look at anatomy, we know it very well from the fossil evidence. And it was around 2 million years ago that you get the ancestors of all of us, first of all, getting much smaller teeth than the people before them, the apes, really. To judge from the nature of the rib cage and the pelvis, it also looks as though they have smaller guts. And that combination of small teeth adapted to relatively soft food and small guts adapted to high-quality food is a very difficult one to explain unless you can invoke the idea of cooked food. And then here's another thing that suggests that at that time they had control of fire, and that is that they were undoubtedly sleeping on the ground from 2 million years onwards. Well, that's because, I mean, we know that, because they lost their climbing adaptations. How could they sleep on the ground full of predators unless they had a good system for protecting themselves from predators? And the only one we know of is the control of fire. So those points suggest that fire was indeed controlled about that time. But then you ask the question another way and say, well, if it wasn't then, well, when could it have been? And the thing is that nothing much happens in human evolution after that time. You know, we were humans and we were becoming a little bit less robust, but we stayed about the same body size and tooth size stayed roughly the same until very recently. So that means that this enormous change that cooked food would have brought undoubtedly to a species could not have happened between about 2 million years ago and the present time.
And so, of course, with that cooked food, so many changes came along. I mean, you talked about how we could process food, get nutrients out of food much more quickly. So if we were eating raw food like chimpanzees do today, we'd spend most of our life eating, right?
Well, that's right. It's an extraordinary observation that if you look at the amount of time that a primate spends chewing its food, just literally moving its jaws up and down, then it's pretty well predictable from their body size. And that means that we can say if we are a species of our own body size and we confined ourselves to eating raw food of the type that primates do, found in the forest, then how much time will we spend chewing? The answer is around 6 or 8 hours a day. So a completely different species. You know, we would have no time for, say, going hunting or patrolling the boundaries of our territories or looking for girlfriends in a neighboring camp if you're a male, or cooking if you're a female, in the sense that that's a lot of what females do. So the whole nature of life would have been completely different. But as it is, humans everywhere around the world, everyone, of course, eats cooked food, and we spend less than an hour a day chewing.
Richard Wrangham, we are looking forward to finding out more at Darwin Day. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. It's a wonderful, and I look forward to being in Iowa at the weekend.
Richard Wrangham is a biological anthropologist and primatologist. He's a professor at Harvard University and founder of the Kibali Chimpanzee Project. He's the author of Demonic Males and Catching Fire. He'll be giving two presentations at Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration, March 3rd and 4th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.